Some people work on Saturdays, particularly if we go to Ireland and if we go live to City Hall in Belfast. We do know that Máirtín Ó-Maolaodha, who is Lord Mayor of Belfast, is on the job, and you're very welcome there, Lord Mayor.
Number one, call me Máirtín, but look, it's always wonderful to be on your show. I hope you're well.
Very good, thank you.
And New York are well.
Now, let me ask you about what is being now hailed as a very successful a workshop, a group of Belfast business leaders who you led to California last week. Many would assume that Belfast is doing terrific, and it is, because indeed at your own invitation we were delighted to spend a week or so in Belfast during the summer there to witness for ourselves the amazing progress that has taken place in Belfast in a relatively short period of time. But tell us about taking the show on the road, as it were, and what prompted that.
Well, we're very fortunate, Adrian, in that in Belfast we have a cadre of ambitious, innovative young entrepreneurs who have set up their own companies. And as the Lord Mayor of Belfast, I put out a call for companies who wanted to go to Silicon Valley to pitch their business, to meet new partners, to try and attract some investment. And we actually 50 companies wanted to take part, and we went for 20. And we went for companies who we thought could benefit most from the mission. And of course, what gives us the edge, I suppose the competitive edge for anyone from Ireland in business, is the Irish American community. So not only do we get a warm welcome in Silicon Valley and San Jose and Portland as well, and indeed from the governor of California, Jerry Brown, but we found that when we went to the real epicenter of venture capital in the world, which is Palo Alto, Sand Hill Road, where we pitched there, that the companies were very happy with how they got on. They pitched in front of venture capitalists, and really we got out of the way as politicians and let them at it.
Let me ask you, in planning a trip like that, is that something, and I know that you're very involved and that this is co-sponsored by Invest Northern Ireland, but is this, have companies throughout, particularly in the tech companies, do they welcome trade missions like that? Is it better for them to actually to have them come, taking the horse to the water rather than vice versa?
Well, I don't think you're going to do well in tech in the Western world, or probably in the world, if you don't have a direct line into Silicon Valley. And therefore, what we did was we brought them to the Bay Area, to Silicon Valley, and that gave them an opportunity to meet with the top people who have backed the most successful tech businesses in the world, and to find out what's the secret sauce, what is needed. And you won't succeed, and if this was the message from Silicon Valley, you won't succeed unless you have a base in Silicon Valley of some type. The other thing worth saying is these are small companies, Adrian. Some of these companies had 20 employees, 30, but some also had 4 or 5. So it's the start almost of their entrepreneurial journey, of their technology journey, and I suspect they will go back under their own steam in the time ahead. Now that we have, I think we have started them on a path. Some actually did some great pieces of business, including one company which made a deal with PayPal, which is going to be very useful for them. But it's like all these visits, and one of the venture capitalists who addressed our entrepreneurs said, look, Silicon Valley isn't about the money, it's about the relationships. And if you want to form lasting relationships that benefit the business, you need to go out regularly, in my view, to Silicon Valley. And for some of the companies have been there before, but others have taken that first step on that path towards tax success.
Yeah, and it makes sense that, again, where you have small companies, that if you show up, en masse, that you even have a better platform, and particularly if it's organized in advance. For many of the companies who went to Silicon Valley, was that their first trip?
Well, I think it was really 50%. 50% had been there before, and 50% the first time. For all of them, I would say for most of them, it was the first time they've been exposed to the full-on generosity of Irish America, because we did a fair bit of prep work in the weeks ahead, talking to the American Ireland Fund, talking to the Irish Network in the Bay Area, talking to the Irish Consul on the West Coast, Phil Grant, the new Irish Consul General on the West Coast, talking to our friends in the Northern Ireland Bureau and Invest NI. So we did quite a lot of work, and the Irish brand is now strong in Silicon Valley when it comes to tech, when it comes to innovation, when it comes to digital companies. There's a little bit of a speed bump when you deal with politicians, because they are unhappy, as you know, with some of the large multinationals who
right.
are being accused of hiding from their tax obligations by using Ireland. But regardless of that, there is an understanding across America, but certainly in the West Coast, that Ireland is a happening place for tax. So that, although we were focusing on Belfast and in a different jurisdiction, I think the brand is building and the image and the buzz was helpful to those companies. So some first time, some had been there before, but all of them, I think, are now really have a strong footing on the ladder, and will only go up in the time ahead.
And of course, it can't hurt that when you are on a mission like that, that you also have some heavy duty endorsements by some of the bigger companies. You know, not bad to have the former Microsoft executive Alfredo Coppola, and venture capitalists like Chris Burry, founder of Avant Corporation. You're not just going in cold. This is something that indeed, or something that is brand new. There has been a lot of success in Irish companies. And sometimes when we think of, the success of Irish companies, we think of Southern Ireland. We don't particularly think of the North or of Belfast. Maybe you can fill us in on that.
Well, I think there's two aspects to that. First, if you're linked into Irish America, or if you're from the island of Ireland, you will never go in cold to America, because the wonderful Irish-American community we have across 50 states, they will go the extra mile to make sure you can open the doors you need to open, or you make the contacts. And, of course, we used that, and I don't want to say the word we exploited that, but certainly we partnered with Irish America to make sure that there was that extra edge for our companies and extra welcome for our companies. But also, it is true that Belfast is now home to the New York Stock Exchange, 300 workers. We're home to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, 100 workers. We're home to CyberSource, a great company set up by New York called Bill McKiernan, now in the West Coast of America.
Right.
We have 1,400 workers from Concentrix. It was my pleasure to visit the CEO of Concentrix, Chris Caldwell, in his office in Fremont, in California, to thank him for investing in Belfast, but ask how we can enhance that investment in the time ahead. And Belfast, of course, we're now about to build probably a $400 million development, which is a new university in the inner city. The whole buzz about the Titanic Belfast tourist attraction, which is, I think, certainly in recent times, probably the most successful tourist destination on the island of Ireland, and also that we are now home to HBO's Game of Thrones. All those things together are creating a critical mass for Belfast, making it easier for us to tell our story, to move away from, as it were, the dark side of the street to the bright side of the road. And there's also an understanding in Silicon Valley, interestingly, there's an understanding that, look, we're out there attracting jobs to build peace. And the CEO of Cisco, John Chambers, recently spent some time in Israel and Palestine. He talks about peace from profits. So there is, you know, there was there's perhaps more goodwill even than there would be for companies from Limerick or Galway or Dublin, because they know that what we're committed to is trying to build the peace with jobs. The last thing I would say in that regard is there's no surprise when we go out looking work, but we're trying to make it a golden bridge which goes both ways, mutual benefit. And I have in San Francisco, I'm very lucky to have a wonderful man called Paul Haller, who is the former abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, and he's a Buddhist priest, comes from Belfast originally, and he's also one of my chaplains as Lord Mayor of Belfast. And Paul addressed a large gathering which the NI Bureau hosted for us in San Francisco on our opening night, and he said, marching has come west looking for work. And he said, many a person in this room did the same thing, or their ancestors did the same thing. And I thought that was a really nice way to put it, because all we're doing is we're trying to find work. In this case, we're trying to bring it back to Belfast, but we want it to be a benefit to America and to American companies, and of course we want to be a benefit to the peace. So it was a mission, I think, that had a higher mission, if we can use that term, than just dollars and cents.
Now, how do you explain when you are meeting and dealing and looking for business, you know, from American companies, you have competition within the island of Ireland itself? You have a very favorable tax structure in Southern Ireland of 12.5%, which indeed is tremendous incentive to companies throughout the world who may in fact be attracted by that very low tax formula, which you can't offer from Northern Ireland. How do you get around that? How do you address that?
Well, I think we do a couple of things. First of all, there is just a little frisson around the tax rate in the Republic of Ireland at the minute, and some of the people we meet don't want to invest to seek a tax advantage, because there has been a backlash against that in America. So in some ways, it'd be nice to offer a more competitive tax regime. On the other hand, it means we're not embroiled in that argument at all about our companies coming here not to create work in Ireland, or not to seek the best talent, but are they coming here to avoid their tax obligations? So in some ways, I'm pleased to avoid that. Secondly, we compete on talent. So we say to people, look, we don't have the same tax advantages you could get in Dundalk or Galway, but we have more talent, and we believe that Belfast is the fastest growing knowledge economy in Europe, not just in Ireland and Britain, but the fastest growing knowledge economy in Europe is Belfast. The number one centre in the world for financial technology business is Belfast. And we say to them, look, if you come here, we will try and make it as easy as possible. Of course, we will try and give you assistance towards your investment, trying to help you with training, tie you in to universities. But I see that actually there's a symbiosis on the island, that the great publicity that we have received from Google being in Dublin, from PayPal being in Ireland, from eBay being in Ireland, that we can use that to our advantage, because Ireland is a happening place. But some companies, believe it or not, Adrian, some companies have operations which aren't focused on profit alone. They have what they call cost centres, and sometimes they'll say, okay, we can put this cost centre in Belfast, but we'll have some of our operations in Dublin. I have been meeting this week again with the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Oisin Quinn. We're working very hard on reviving the idea of the Eastern Economic Corridor, and I think that will give us an added opportunity to say to companies, look, we know you want to come to Ireland because we speak English, which is good for American companies. The time zone is quite good for global companies. We're halfway to India, halfway to the west coast of America. We do have the talent, but as well as that, we want to say, look, the Eastern Corridor, it's only a small island, of course, Adrian, but the Eastern Corridor, 100 miles Belfast to Dublin, that is where you should be based. And if you want today to go to Dublin or put some of your operations there in some of Belfast at a later date, we can live with that, or vice versa. So the island's too small, in my view, to be cutting each other's throats, but we can compete for our cities and be proud of our cities. But at the same time, I'm neither going to begrudge Derry or Dublin investment if they go out and win it as well.
Yeah, and to offset the difference in the tax structure. You've definitely been very successful in utilizing, you know, added incentives, and therein, you know, you have a lot going for you, say, in Belfast when you, you know, when you just the waterways, the famous docks in Belfast, the Titanic and the Titanic Centre, which is now a focal point and very helpful in terms of tourism. But there are, you know, you're not starting from scratch.
No, we're not starting from scratch. And the other little, I suppose, secret weapon, if you wish, is that often the boardrooms of America, when decisions are made because a company is going to be successful in California, and Governor Brown said this, like of the companies, the biggest companies in California, over 50% of their sales are outside of America. So they understand for companies to be truly successful, they have to be based in Europe in this case, and that Ireland, and we're arguing Belfast, a great gateway to Europe. So we're not, we come with a strong proposition, I think, to the companies we are dealing with. But I have to say as well that often when you scratch under a corporate decision, you find out that there's an Irish man or an Irish woman involved. And
right.
That has been true of so many investments I have seen. Allstate has around 2,500 workers across Derry and Belfast and Strabane. And that was a decision made in their Illinois headquarters by an Irish person, an Irish American, who brought it to the board. I know when Caterpillar, which has announced another large $12 million investment in Belfast yesterday, when Caterpillar first made its decision, it was part of GE, and I remember speaking to guys in GE at that time on the board who were parts of the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick. And so and of course the cyber source, Bill McKiernan, wanted to help the peace process. So of course the investments will only happen if they are profitable. But I do find that we are very blessed for the fact that there are people within these boards at very senior positions because of the rise of Irish in America. People in very senior positions who are willing to put Belfast on the table or put Derry on the table. Of course, also put Dublin and Cork on the table. And we have to continue to do that. And you know, I'm working with the American Ireland Fund, and next year we hope to bring in the first ever investment mission that the American Ireland Fund has endorsed to Belfast, first time ever to Ireland, it will be. And I do believe that, you know, it won't only be multinational companies, it could be individuals who say, well, I want to make an investment in a hotel, or I want to make an investment in new student accommodation
right.
to complement the new university. But this, I would never underestimate the part that Irishness and Irish heritage plays in getting us into the room in which the decision is made, and neither would I underestimate the importance of that Irish connection in getting a decision over the line.
Now, having said that, when it comes to investment and when it comes to business, there's very little Grow McCree left, which sometimes we need to explain, and that is, yes, the peace process in Northern Ireland not only is helped, but it depends on the goodwill. The bottom line in all of this is that you have to produce. You have to give the value for money. This is not this is not a charitable venture. This is good, solid investment. And that's what it is. So there is a fine line there. But Belfast, Northern Ireland, for that matter, the island of Ireland, has got to produce and has got to have that very positive track record and throughout the world, which it already has.
Well, and you know, and the reality is, and we could say that's on the program because our listeners are Irish Americans, is we can be our own worst enemy. That the only negative publicity from Belfast as a location comes from the actions of the people who live here. So we have a job of work to do, and as first citizen of Belfast, I've been doing my own outreach into those who still want to engage in protest in the city to try and explain to them listen, guys, you can't have it both ways. If you want to engage in actions which will end up with attacks on the police, well, they will be broadcast around the world. And when decisions are being made about investment or decisions being made by individuals saying, where will I go on holiday, you will influence that, those decisions negatively. So, you know, I'm aware that we are in a competitive world, that there's great goodwill towards Belfast. But we need to get our act together, and we're making good progress in terms of the things that continue to divide us. And one of the principles of my mayoralty has been that I want to focus on the common ground, that 90% of my time is spent on the bright side of the road. There are some people who still want to stay on the dark side of the street and live in the past and argue and spend all our time arguing about the things which we know divide us, because we feel passionately about things like flags and anthems and other things here, and as you know, in Belfast,
yes.
But the secret has to be, and the magic of the Good Friday Agreement was that we could disagree about those matters, but we could move on in a united fashion. And I think that we can show that united front to the rest of the world. All those investment decisions, and I'm not only talking about big business, I'm not talking about small investments even by venture capital companies into some of our early stage companies, but I'm thinking of people who make that individual investment of saying, where will I go on my vacation this year? Will I include Belfast? We need to make sure that they know that Belfast is moving forward, that there will be a warm welcome, that it's a safe city to visit, and that really any visit to the island of Ireland, which doesn't include Belfast, for an Irish-American, in my view, is wholly incomplete. Our figures show this year over 1 million visitors in 14 months to the Titanic Belfast Centre. That message is getting through, but we need to work harder at it, and we need to look at ourselves here at home to make sure that that message goes out 365 days a week, and that we don't become our own worst enemy. And we're going in the right direction, Peter.
Now, you are and have been a prominent member of the Sinn Féin political party. What is your own reaction when you hear us, and particularly across America, when on one hand we celebrate the Good Friday Agreement, but then we have to underline how fragile the peace process is in Northern Ireland? Is that overkill on our part?
Well, it's the reality. And you know, I remain always positive and optimistic, but the reality is that the peace process only works if it's like a bicycle. It has to be moving forward or it will fall. We will suffer setbacks from time to time. President Obama has sent Special Envoy Richard Haass here because we continue to disagree about the past, and the past, as Martin McGuinness said recently, can undermine and destroy our hopes for the future. So I think that it is correct to say that these are testing times for the peace. On the other hand, the great good news from Belfast is that in the last, 3 years, we have had three killings and politically linked violence. I note that Chicago this year, the great city of Chicago, has had 540 homicides. And you know, I have great respect for Rahm Emanuel and great love for the Irish-American people of Chicago. But to put it in context, when we talk about difficulties, those difficulties, I think, are around the politicians being unable to unite around the promise and the pledge and of the Good Friday Agreement. So there's more work to do.
Right.
I have always said, and you know, since I really started going seriously to Irish-America, in 2007, I've always said to people, look, we need really to nurture, embrace, and build the peace process. And in my view, and John Hume was saying this 30, 40 years ago, the best way to build the peace is through jobs. And, you know, John Hume said many years ago, if every Irish American spent $100 per year, it would be a big boost to the economy. That remains true. That remains true. But we need to make sure whatever Irish American spends is $100 or that it's good value,
yeah,
that it's best in the world, and that it gives a reward as well. So I remain confident about the peace process. This is a city transformed. We're in the middle of the Belfast Festival. We just hosted the World Peace and Fire Games, 7,000 competitors, largest ever competition, sporting competition in terms of competitors in the world. We're gearing up next year to bring the Giro d'Italia, third biggest cycle race in the world, to Belfast. 220 competitors will be watched by 700 million people around the world, and they will see that bright side of the road. But you know, I have a great friend in Derry, Garvin O'Doherty, and he made peace between the apprentice boys and the Bogside residents, which was quite an achievement in Derry. That every year now the apprentice boys parade, which was bedeviled with trouble for 40 years. It is one of the most peaceful parades in any city in the north of Ireland at present. And yet we had 550 parades on 12th of July, two had trouble, and a lot of trouble. So we're not quite there yet. But Garvin has said recently in some of his public utterances, I heard him saying the Good Friday Agreement is a 30-year journey, and we're 15 years down.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, and that's his view, and my opinion is then let's settle down, let's do the work that has to be done to make sure that this gift of peace, the greatest gift ever to those of us who live here, but also to Irish America, because I know that Irish America was so anguished during the years of trouble here, that we need to make sure in the next 15 years, or if it's the next 50 or next 500, that we work as hard to defend the peace as we worked in the past to ensure that everybody here was treated equally. So I suppose that's our pledge. I mean, that's what drives me to go to Silicon Valley. Of course, I would love these young companies to do well. They're all great people. And of course, it'd be great if there were more jobs in Belfast. But I'm not doing it just for those fine reasons. I'm doing it as well because I believe this will cement the peace in the time ahead. And I do believe that many of our Irish American colleagues, when they make these investments or make these connections or help these businesses, they're doing it as well, not only because it makes sense for them, because there's profit at the end of the road, but because they also know it will help build the peace.
For all of the publicity worldwide with the Titanic story, sometimes we're of the opinion shipbuilding, the world famous Harlan and Wolff shipbuilding, that somehow that's past tense, and that in fact Belfast, used to be a very prominent place throughout the world for shipbuilding and so forth. But you also have a message to deliver. Which we found ourselves in our recent trip to Belfast, is that Belfast Harbour, that the development through the Belfast Harbour Commission, that shipping is still a very prominent feature of Belfast. This is not a distant memory of days long gone.
No, the port remains, I suppose, the biggest economic driver in the city of Belfast, because on the port land, of course, there are 6,000 workers in the Bombardier factory who have just, amazingly, the engineers there have created a new resin to make the wings for the new C-Series Bombardier jet. So all these years later, from in a country in which there are no customers for these jets, Belfast continues to make jets. We're not making ships, so the shipyard still exists with a smaller number of renovating ships. But the harbour recently made a $75 million investment so that we could be part of this renewable industry. So in Belfast today, if you go up to the mountain above Belfast, the Black Mountain or Cave Hill, when you look down on the city, the landscape has changed because with these huge wind turbines being assembled in Belfast Port. And, you know, the port this week unveiled a beautiful piece of art showing the seahorse of Belfast. The seahorse is a symbol of Belfast. And when we went down to do that, they're very proud of the fact that Belfast is 400 years of age this year. So 1613 was the charter given to the city of Belfast, and we celebrate that 400 years today. Now, some of my colleagues have some concerns about that because they say there were people here before 1613. Of course there were. Of course there were. But that's history and that's heritage, and I'm, you know, very happy to embrace that and be proud of the fact that the city of Belfast is 400 year old, even while we acknowledge that, of course, there were people here long before that, and they too, I think, have added to the wonder and the genius and the brilliance of Belfast. So, you know, the harbour remains more than just a body involved in shipping.
Right.
They're trying to drive forward the rebirth of that area of Belfast around Titanic, because that is largely their project, and I think they're having some success in that. And for the first time, really, due to the work of the harbour and their friends in the Titanic Quarter, we now have people living in the city centre again. And you know, in the regeneration of all the great American cities that we've seen over the last 15 or 20 years, people living downtown, is absolutely key. So it really thrills me, Adrian. For the first time, you know, that I remember, I see young people walking, shopping, jogging in the city centre, young families moving back, especially to the Titanic Quarter. And that has to be a key element of the new Belfast, of the future Belfast. So we have, in many ways, a really united voice from all the partners across Belfast who believe in rebuilding the city, and of course growing the size of the city and growing the scale of the city, and that has to be first and foremost more people living here, and in many ways they are the new Irish or the new Belfast people, because they're coming from all over the world to live here to avail of these new technology jobs, and I think that Belfast is the better for it.
Now this is the centenary of the famous 1913 lockout, and maybe you'll just explain a little bit as to what part of history in the labour movement, what is the significance of what is referred to as the lockout of 1913?
Well, I suppose that the Dublin lockout was the seminal battle between labour and, I suppose, capital, are the upper class in Ireland at that time, and the famed William Murphy took on the unions, Largan and Connolly, led to that bitter, long dispute of the Dublin lockout that led to, of course, many great relationships being built, especially in Dublin and Liverpool, where many children were sent to Liverpool to seek refuge in, there during the length of the lockout, and probably also was the spark that lit the Irish Citizen Army's involvement in the 1916 rising. And when the labour movement in Ireland looks back over the last 100 years, that moment is probably the proudest moment, and really is the moment which gave birth, I think, to the modern labour movement in Belfast. We look back a little bit farther to the Docker strike of 1907, again being a seminal moment when, you know, when people talk about the great strength of the empire and the strength of Belfast and the shipbuilding and so on, obviously that was built on the backs of ordinary people, and often conditions were onerous and punitive. So the lockout is being celebrated throughout this year in Ireland, and of course it's being celebrated in America as well, because of the huge connections between labour in America and labour in Ireland. And last night in my parlour, I was very pleased to have a delegation of some of the most important labour leaders in America, Irish Americans, who were here, who are in Ireland at the invitation of Sinn Féin, who had been in Dublin, and they were in my parlour last night. That was a special moment. Chuck Donoghue was here, Terry O'Sullivan was here, John Hegarty, who's in charge of one of the mail unions, was here, and we had a really great conversation with them and how they felt the Irish had contributed to the labour movement in America, but also how fortunes, you know, they talk about capital being worldwide at the minute, and that's true. Capital is global. But labour movements are also global, and the protection of workers' pay and conditions is also a global cause. And that's last night it was good to see those two labour movements, which are absolutely, they're linked at the hip because of the Irish, to be able to welcome that small group to City Hall and to I suppose, renew those bonds of friendship with the labour movement in America.
Now, just before we move on from that, was there a political aspect to the lockout, or was this something which had very little to do with 100 years ago, actually with the crown? Was this within the labour movement itself, without any political strings, as it were?
Well, you know, I actually think that the politics of labour in Ireland has always been entwined with the politics of the national question, and the issues thrown up by the lockout and issues thrown up by 1916, which was probably the last time labour and the national movement united as one to seek independence. So those issues are alive today in the parties which owe their allegiance, I suppose, to labour in this country, and those parties that some are focused on the national question perhaps more, and some are focused on labour more, and some are, I suppose, equally focused on both. But I do think it was a time of political awakening. I don't think you would have had 1916 without 1913, and you wouldn't have had then independence of the Irish Free State without 1916, and you wouldn't have had the Civil War. So deeply political in my view, and really, I think, set the character of the revolution, if you wish, the revolutionary
yeah.
years. And some people would say then that was pushed back after 1921 and 22, that it was, there was a pushback against Labour, and we had many years of, I suppose, what nowadays we would describe as right-wing administrations, but probably been called more conservative administrations or governments in the years since. And perhaps only now is the push for Labour era, if you wish, as strong as it was in 1913 because of the policies of austerity. No matter how well-intentioned, across Europe, that those policies of austerity are certainly grueling, creating grueling times for ordinary people. Huge emigration again from the island of Ireland. It's heartbreaking to see that, but even more heartbreaking for me is to see so many people unemployed and all this great talent we have in the country, especially
yeah.
among young people. But 30% of our young people are unemployed in Dublin and Belfast, 20% of our young people unemployed. Nothing more heartbreaking than idleness, in my view. And I can understand then young people wanting to get out. And it's just a tragedy, of course, that those young people can't go west to seek work anymore because they can't get into
yeah.
to the United States.
Yeah, well, that's scale Ella for law Ella, because that in itself is obviously something that we're very... have been very concerned about, and that is obviously that somehow the United States has, in addition to the rest of our troubles, has somehow managed to block, under the heading of immigration and border security and all that goes with that, is that they've also managed block a great number of young people who unfortunately have to leave Ireland because of the overall downturn in the economy, and more specifically because of tremendous reform that is taking place, economic reform that is taking place in Ireland. Hopefully that will be addressed now that Washington has finally gotten a hold of some of the reality and the time wasted over the months on the tremendous diversity that we have with the major political parties here. But I want to come back to the... it is well known, indeed, that your career has been as a leader and, in fact, an owner of Belfast Media Group, which, among other aspects, has in New York, a very New York American connection through the Irish Echo newspaper. And you have taken this year, the centenary year, as a very special year to honour a great number of Labour leaders throughout America. And that event actually is taking place, oh my God, we're nearly there, on Friday, November 8th here in the Sheraton Hotel. Now, in honouring America's labour legacy, as it were, that is timely for a couple of reasons, because we hear and some believe that labour and the labour force has undergone a tremendous setback, as it were, that people are indeed pointing fingers and have managed to do so, particularly in recent decades, and say, well, you know, it's because of labor, it's because of the unions that we're in the Shochron that we are in, they have been contributors to to the downturn in the economy and whatever. Is this an American interpretation, or is this kind of worldwide? Do we have does labor become the scapegoat for for recessions and whatever? Are they an easy target?
Well, I think the correct answer to that would come from a gentleman called Robbie Hunter, who is the Belfast-born president of the California Building Trades Council, which has 400,000 members. He's more members than there are people in Belfast. And I had great privilege to meet him. He left Belfast in 1978 to meet him when I was in Berkeley at the invitation of the mayor of Berkeley, Tom Bates. And what Robbie Hunter said in a little address he gave, he said, look, when we call for union labor on building projects in California, and of course he's deeply committed to new infrastructure projects in California, he says, we say use labor because we understand the developer has to make a profit. So we're here to make sure that happens. He says, when we build it, when our members build it, they build it right. They build it once. It will stay up. It will be done professionally. It will be done on time. So he was arguing very much for a partnership between labour and capital and labour in the private sector. And that would be my view as well, that, you know, you can't, that we all need to be on the same side of this argument, that there needs to be an alliance and a partnership between the private sector, the unions, government, especially at this time when there are these recessionary times when there isn't enough private sector building going on. But of course, yes, there can be criticisms of practices that people may say. I think this is more in America than they would say it in Ireland. The criticism of labour, criticism of unions. On the whole, in my view, Ireland has been better for the labour movement. America has been better for the labour movement. And when I meet people like Ed Smith, who I met last night from Chicago, head of the Builders Union in Chicago, and he's actually using his pension fund to invest in projects which are built by union labour and which then give a return to the pension fund. So he was telling me that famous Staples Center in LA, I believe, that his union invested $130 million in that project to make it happen. And of course today they get a return. So I'm for innovation, I'm for working hard, but I also do believe, Robbie Hunter, that California is better for recognizing its labour unions. And in fact, when we were there last weekend, or the weekend before, Governor Brown had just signed into law two pieces of legislation which would probably be more progressive than similar legislation in Ireland, legislation around prevailing wage and to ensure that unions are engaged in some of these huge new infrastructure projects in California. So when we honour the 100 labour leaders, and, you know, we're doing something particularly special because I can't think of one person who has appeared on the Irish Echo labour listing previously that hasn't also made a big contribution to Irish America. And you know, we talk about Jack O'Hearn, we talk about Chuck Donahue, we talk about Terry O'Sullivan. So many of these people, their contribution hasn't been limited. And although that's an important contribution, their contribution hasn't been limited to labour. They've also always been great friends to Ireland as well. So,
does make such a difference because actually it has been such a contributory factor to peace and to peace in the North, because when it's, you know, it has often been said that if there is no employment, if somebody doesn't have a job and it is infectious in that it goes on to the next generation and the next generation, religion political affinity doesn't mean that much. As a matter of fact, nobody cares at that point. If you're not employed, if you have no hope for employment, then that takes that's the reverse of those who think, you know, Catholics and Protestants are at each other's throats, nationalists and unionists are the cause of the strife in Northern Ireland. It comes down to, you know, who's got jobs and what's on offer. That's healing in itself, and it has indeed influenced greatly and continues to work on the peace process.
Well, absolutely. And our great friend, the late Inez McCormick, used to say the most integrated part of society in North of Ireland was the work, was the shop floor. And that's a testament to the power of the McBride principles, because they enforced the concept that you will employ in this part of the world only on merit. And that's a key building block of the peace process. And, you know, I see a lot of the new investments, people who come to the city, they would be flabbergasted at the suggestion that when we recruit for new companies, we would recruit on the basis of where people pray on a Sunday rather than on a merit. So I've seen those changes in my lifetime, and the more efforts we make and the more activity we have which brings people together, the better for this society. And the labour movement has made its own contribution to that. You know, we're indebted to a series of controllers in New York who not only fought for the right of fair employment, but also who have been working hard to find ways to invest in the peace, to invest in capital or other projects which can get a return for the organised labour of the public sector in places like New York and New York State, the police officers, the teachers, and so on.
Yeah.
And that's a little project which we need to do more work on in the time ahead, Adrian, because I think that Controller Liu, Controller Dinopoli, have done great work in finding and blazing a path in this regard. But I think on our side of the water, we have failed to put up the projects which could absorb that investment, help to build physical development plus jobs here, and then make a return to the fire officers and the teachers and so on in New York in the time ahead. So
there'll be a new opportunity there. Lord Mayor of Belfast, Martin O'Mueller, we have a new administration coming on board after 12 years of the Mike Bloomberg administration. So there will be new opportunities, and there'll be a lot of changes here as well. I want to return to, and finally, to the Irish Echo Awards banquet, again scheduled for Friday, November 8th, and it's at the Sheraton in Times Square. Now, guest speaker, Gerry Adams. For a lot of people, a lot of people have heard and have read, but so many people have not had an opportunity to actually to meet and to experience some of the insights. And God knows, among other things, he is a tremendous and well-known orator. He's the guest speaker.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important to say how proud I am of the Irish Echo team, and from Ray O'Hanlon, his editor, through all our friends, Madeline, Maria, and so on, who put these events together. But I'm also very proud of the fact that each year we have had the Irish Labour event that Gerry Adams has made time to attend and to speak.
Right.
I know that Irish America holds a special place in his heart. Irish America has a special place in its heart for Gerry Adams as well, and those of us who have been at events that he has addressed or attended knows that the affection of Irish America towards Gerry Adams, I think, actually gives him a great boost, helps him to continue to do the work of peacemaking and nation building that he's involved in. And it's always, I think, a special occasion when Gerry Adams addresses Irish America.
Right.
The issue of labour, of course, is something that's very dear to his heart as well, something he's been writing on for, I'm sure, four decades and talking about and organising along. So I think for him it's one of the events which gives him great pleasure to attend. But I really do know, no matter where I travel in Irish America, that there's a fondness for Gerry Adams, there's affection for Gerry Adams, and that people are always pleased to get an opportunity to meet with him or to listen to him. So it is the icing on the cake, in my view, that for the Irish Echo event. And we have had politicians from all parties address Irish Echo events, but it is the icing on the cake that Gerry Adams will be there in New York on the 8th of November. And I plan to be there myself as well. Adrian, I'm taking a year out of my business, but that's one event I intend to attend this year, and I hope to look forward to meeting all our friends.
Obviously the endorsement, the sponsorship of the Labour International Union of North America indeed also gives an opportunity for Terry O'Sullivan, who is also guest speaker there. As a matter of fact, he is a special guest speaker who will be addressing that the group.
Yeah, and he's a fierce orator in his own right, so he is. So that'll be, I think that between them, they should raise the roof at this yard and towers that night, I suspect, Adrian.
Yeah, he'll give Jerry Adams a run for it.
I would say he would. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Lord Mayor of Belfast, and again, Martin O'Mueller, as we link up live to Belfast. And again, Martin, thank you for being with us today. Thanks, Martin.
My pleasure, and always great. I hope forward. I hope we can see you on the 8th of November. But
absolutely.
Thank you for all you do and all your service for Irish America and for Ireland to you, Anya. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And friends, let me just give you some information here now. There are still a couple of nominations for the Labour, for the Irish Echoes, Irish Labour 100, and also for information, of course, for the event itself, which is taking place on Friday, November 8th. You can actually go to www.irishecho.com, or indeed, if you want to get information, you can call Madeline O'Boyle, and her number is 212-482-4818. That's Madeline O'Boyle. And friends, our guest on the program today, Lord Mayor of Belfast, live from Belfast City Hall, Martin O'Mueller. You are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. It is 9 minutes